From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Welcome to the birthplace of payday lending. Today, what's a payday loan and why are millions of Americans falling deeper and deeper into debt? Then, as more U.S. troops head to Afghanistan, President Obama's unveiling a new strategy there. We'll hear what Afghans have to say.
The Afghan will never accept the military presence of any country, even if that's Saudi Arabia, if that's U.S.
And we'll speak with Prothap Chatterjee of CorpWatch. He's just back from Afghanistan, then Iraq.
So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
While President Obama says his plan is to withdraw all combat troops from Iraq, investigative journalist Gareth Porter says new evidence reveals the U.S. plans to keep combat brigades in Iraq just under a different name. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Obama administration is expected to unveil proposals today to boost government authority over the financial system. In addition to previously announced powers to seize troubled non-banking firms, the administration's plan would reportedly expand federal regulation for the first time to cover financial derivatives trading, large hedge funds, and insurers such as AIG. Regulators would also impose uniform standards to limit the range of functions of major financial firms, including banks. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers continue negotiations on the final version of President Obama's budget plan. On Wednesday, the House Budget Committee voted to back the measure after trimming tens of billions of dollars from the original proposal. The Senate Budget Committee is expected to vote on its version later today. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has admitted U.S. drug policy has not only been a failure, but has in fact fueled Mexico's drug war. Speaking to reporters at the outset of her trip to Mexico, Clinton said, quote, clearly what we've been doing has not worked. I feel very strongly we have a co-responsibility. Our insatiable demand for illegal drugs fuels the drug trade. Our inability to prevent weapons from being illegally smuggled across the border to arm these criminals causes the deaths of police, of soldiers, and civilians. Clinton's comments are being called the most far-reaching by a senior U.S. official in accepting responsibility for the rampant drug trade. In Pakistan, at least 11 people have been killed in two separate U.S. drone attacks. Pakistani officials said the dead were foreign militants. Hundreds of people have died in U.S. missile strikes inside Pakistan. The Wall Street Journal reports U.S. and Pakistani officials are finalizing a new list of targets along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. The cooperation comes despite U.S. accusations that Pakistan's top intelligence agency is directly supporting Taliban fighters and other militants inside Afghanistan. According to the New York Times, U.S. officials are now accusing elements of Pakistani intelligence of directly funding and supplying Taliban commanders. The U.S. and Israel are being accused of killing up to 39 people in a bombing attack in Sudan this past January. According to reports, U.S. or Israeli forces allegedly attacked a convoy of 17 trucks suspected of carrying weapons intended for smuggling into the Gaza Strip. A Sudanese government minister confirmed the strike, saying, quote, a major power carried it out. In Israel and the occupied territories, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of unlawfully attacking densely populated civilian areas with white phosphorus during its three-week attack on Gaza. In a new report, Human Rights Watch says the white phosphorus killed at least 12 Palestinian civilians and destroyed millions of dollars worth of property. Bill Vanisveld of Human Rights Watch says the phosphorus use likely amounts to a war crime.
It looks like that evidence is consistent with war crimes being committed. A war crime is when there is either intent or recklessness with regard to targeting civilians or civilian institutions. What we've got here is a lot of different civilian institutions being burned down, a lot of different civilians being injured, and it continued to happen for no apparent justification. That's why we're concerned.
In other news from Israel, the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to become what he called a partner for peace with the Palestinians.
I think that Palestinians should understand that they have in our government a partner for peace, for security, and for rapid economic development of the Palestinian economy. peace is not the last goal. It's a common and enduring goal for all Israelis and all Israeli governments, mine included. This means that I will negotiate with the Palestinian Authority for peace.
Despite vowing to work for peace, Netanyahu's speech failed to even mention the creation of a Palestinian state. Netanyahu has consistently rejected Palestinian statehood and backed the ongoing expansion of Jewish-only Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In Peru, a summit of indigenous groups is gathering to discuss the environmental threats to their communities. Indigenous leader Norma Mayo says energy extraction is endangering areas across the Southern Hemisphere.
Those guilty of global warming are the developed nations who came to our countries to take oil and minerals and leave our forests contaminated. This has hurt our children and our families. They are poor and malnutrition is rising.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling on G20 leaders to establish a $1 trillion stimulus package for poorer countries threatened by the global financial meltdown. Ban told the Financial Times he will make a formal request at the G20 summit in London next week. He is, meanwhile, helping to mark an International Day of Observance for victims of the slave trade at the United Nations.
Africa has yet to recover from the ravages of the slave trade or the subsequent era of colonization. And here in the New World, and in Europe, and elsewhere, people of African descent still struggle daily against entrenched prejudice that keeps them disproportionately in poverty. Despite the official abolition of slavery, racism still pollutes our world.
Here in New York, Governor David Paterson and state lawmakers have reached a deal on further undoing the draconian Rockefeller drug laws. The agreement would repeal an unknown number of mandatory minimum prison sentences for low-level drug crimes and grant judges discretion to order treatment rather than prison time. The measure also calls for a $50 million expansion to drug courts and treatment programs. It's unclear, however, how many prisoners would be able to apply, have their sentences commuted. Paterson was once arrested for protesting the Rockefeller drug laws himself. But according to reports, he's seeking to limit the number of prisoners eligible to apply for commutation. In Vermont, Governor Jim Douglas says he'll veto a same-sex marriage bill if one crosses his desk. Vermont's state Senate voted to legalize same-sex marriage on Monday, and a House vote is expected soon. It's unclear if supporters will have the required majority to override a veto. If the bill becomes law, Vermont will become the first state to legalize same-sex marriage without being forced by the courts to do so. Democratic Senator Benjamin Cardin of Maryland has introduced a measure aimed at rescuing the struggling newspaper industry. The Newspaper Revitalization Act would let newspaper companies become educational nonprofits and operate similar to public broadcasters. Audiences would be eligible to give tax-deductible donations while advertising and subscription revenue would become tax-exempt. Cardin said, quote, "The business model for newspapers based on circulation and advertising revenue is broken, and that is a real tragedy for communities across the nation and for our democracy." The computer giant IBM has announced plans to lay off 5,000 U.S. workers. The number amounts to around 4% of IBM's workforce. And the African-American scholar and author John Hope Franklin has died. Franklin pioneered the field of African-American studies. His book, From Slavery to Freedom, is considered a definitive work on the African-American experience. Franklin recently spoke about the significance of President Obama's ascent to the White House.
It's amazing. It's remarkable. And it's an indication of the willingness as well as the ability of this country to turn a significant corner toward full political equality. I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime. My mother and I used to have a little game we'd play on our public. She would say, if anyone asks you what you want to be when you grow up, tell them you want to be the first Negro president of the United States. And just the words were so far-fetched, so incredible, that we used to really have fun just saying it. I'm hesitant to talk about the obstacles. They exist. And anyone who's lived in the United States 10 minutes knows that they exist. The question is, does he have the capacity and the resources to overcome them? And I believe he does.
Dr. John Hope Franklin, he died at the age of 94. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Lawmakers and public officials in California, Ohio, South Carolina, Missouri, Washington, and other states are attempting to crack down on the controversial practice known as payday lending. On Wednesday, the governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear, signed into law a 10-year moratorium on new payday lenders in the state. Payday loans are short-term loans or cash advances secured by a post-dated check. The annual interest rate for these loans can be as high as 400%, 10 times the highest credit card rates. Consumers who renew their loans often end up paying more in fees than they had originally borrowed. Critics say the system is a form of predatory lending that traps the poor in a cycle of debt.
In the early 90s, there were fewer than 200 payday lending stores in the country. Today, it's a $40 billion industry with more than 22,000 stores. There are more payday lending stores than McDonald's and Starbucks combined. As more Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, the demand for payday loans is increasing. We're joined now by two guests who've been following the story. Journalist Daniel Brook joins us from Philadelphia. His article, Usury Country, Welcome to the Birthplace of Payday Lending, appears in the new issue of Harper's. He's also the author of the book, The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner-Take-All America. And we're joined by Gina Green of the Center for Responsible Lending. The group's releasing a report today that reveals payday lenders are significantly more concentrated in African American and Latino neighborhoods in California than in white neighborhoods. Daniel Brook, let's begin with you in Philadelphia. A very interesting piece in Harper's. You begin in Johnson City, Tennessee, where I'm actually headed in the next few weeks. Talk about exactly what payday loans are.
A payday loan is a short-term, high-interest loan. Here's a typical transaction. Let's say you work at a fast food restaurant, and you're going to get paid next Friday, but you've had an unexpected expense, say, your car broke down, and you need money now. You would go to a payday lender, you'd write out a check for, say, $230, and they'd give you $200 in cash right then. The check, you know, would be bad, and it would be dated to your next payday. Then when your next payday rolls around, you're supposed to reappear at the payday lender and buy your check back in cash for the full $230 value. Now, on the face of it, it already sounds like a high-interest loan, but it's typically much worse than that, because the percentage of borrowers who, when their payday comes around, are able to pay it off is very small. I mean, even industry-sponsored research shows that only a quarter of borrowers are able to consistently pay off their payday loans when they come due at the end, at their first pay period. State research shows rates in the 70s or 80s, or close to 90% of borrowers can't pay these off. So it's clearly a debt trap.
Now, Daniel Brook, you also profile several of the entrepreneurs who began developing these stores and then expanded them into chains. James Eaton, Alan Jones. How did they get to create these huge chains in such a short period of time?
Well, the reason the industry exploded so quickly is that it was serving a growing market. In your introduction, you said that payday loans are targeted towards the poor, and I think it depends on how we define the poor. I would say they're targeted towards the lower middle class. I mean, anyone who takes out a payday loan has to have a bank account, which already gets rid of the unbanked, which is tens of millions of people, including 20% of Latinos and African Americans. So it's people who have jobs, but they're jobs that pay generally under $10 an hour and have inadequate benefits. So basically, this is a group of people that, as we know, is growing. The largest employer in the country, a private employer in the country, is Walmart, and we know what their wages are like. So as this group of people who are living paycheck to paycheck, now 47% of Americans report living paycheck to paycheck, as this group has grown, the market for these predatory payday loans has grown as well.
Gina Green, talk about how these payday loans affect different groups of people.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I wanted to also correct the introduction. You mentioned California possibly tackling payday loans this year, and it's not clear whether or how California will do that. We're using our report today that you mentioned to try and put forth the idea that California should, in fact, address payday loans. One of the key findings of our report that's coming out today, predatory profiling, the role of race and ethnicity in the location of payday lenders in California, is that in this state, payday lenders are 8 times more concentrated in African American and Latino neighborhoods than in white neighborhoods. And even after we account for factors like income, education, poverty rates, we find that they're still 2.4 times more concentrated in African American and Latino neighborhoods. I think this research has borne out what many people have thought we've known intuitively, that payday loans appear to really cluster in black and brown neighborhoods.
And does your report speculate on the reasons for that of the companies that do concentrate in those neighborhoods?
You know, we've got the facts and the data to back up the claim, but we really can't get to the purpose or to the intent of payday lenders. Can we say that they're actually targeting African Americans and Latinos for a particular reason? No, and I would say that that's a really good question for a payday lender. What we do know is that in California, California borrowers lose $450 million a year just to pay payday loan fees. Of that amount, more than half, $247 million, comes from African American and Latino borrowers.
Daniel Brook, explain exactly how you take out a payday loan, the process of going into the store, and again, who started these stores and why they've grown into this, what, $40 billion industry?
Well, the process seems quite innocuous at first. I went into a check-into-cash store. This is the company I profile, which is the first of the major national payday lending firms. And you fill out a basic two-sided information sheet with your name, the name of your landlord or mortgage holder, three people in the community who know you well, your employer, and your spouse. And it takes, you know, really a matter of minutes. You write your check and you get your cash. When this document sort of comes around to bite you is if, when and if you fall behind on payments. And at that point, all of these people start getting collection calls, as well as you yourself who took out the loan. As I said, this was in Check Into Cash, which was the first of the national payday lending chains. And it was founded by a man named Alan Jones, who I had the pleasure of interviewing at his headquarters in Cleveland, Tennessee. Mr. Jones is a rather fascinating character and quite taken with his own being a fascinating character. Essentially, Cleveland, Tennessee's culture has been hijacked by Jones. I went on Halloween when the local townspeople make a pilgrimage to the History Museum to look at the costume that Alan Jones created for his daughter's birthday many years ago. Then they go to the block party and concert that Alan Jones created to get the townspeople off of his lawn when he used to appear in costume as Tall Betsy, who he had named the official ghoul of Bradley County, Tennessee.
Daniel Brook, especially these chains, I would assume that they would need some investors or some capital to be able to expand rapidly and provide this cash to the working poor. Did you look into what were the financial institutions that were investing or behind these chains?
Yes, I did. Check Into Cash itself is a privately held company. Controlled by Alan Jones, but they told me when I went to company headquarters that they had a large line of credit from Wells Fargo Bank. Some of the other chains, including Advance America, which is the largest of the payday lending chains, are publicly traded on the stock exchange and are funded, have lines of credit from all the major banks in the United States, including Citigroup, JP Morgan, et cetera.
Daniel, you mentioned, you know, you get calls if you don't pay back your loans, but could you go more into that, the frequency of these calls and the relationships that they develop?
Yeah, well, initially, when you go into the store, they cultivate these sort of chummy customer relationships between the person behind the desk and the debtor. It's typical, and they're actually instructed in training to, you know, ask about the person's family and their job and how they're doing. Of course, these relationships get more and more strained as the person gets more and more desperate and farther into debt.
I'd like to ask Jenna Green, in your report for the Center for Responsible Lending on the California situation, could you talk to us about what were some of the epicenters in California of this saturation of these lending institutions?
Absolutely. As you can imagine, Los Angeles, with approximately 313 payday stores in the city, was one, and a large proportion of African Americans and Latinos was one of the epicenters of this problem. We will have interactive payday maps as well as maps documenting this concentration on our website later today. What I wanted to note about what Daniel was just saying earlier about the debt trap and how the payday loans are a fundamental problem because they trap people in cycles of debt. One of the reasons why our policy recommendation for payday loans is a simple 36% rate cap that covers all small loans is because it's the only thing that works, and it's the only thing that will keep, that will protect the working poor. It's the only thing that will protect African Americans and Latinos in California. What we found is that more than half of borrowers tend to just take a payday loan because the location was right there. So that proximity and that clustering for African American and Latinos is really critical. Having them in communities makes people more likely to just walk in and take a loan.
Daniel Brook, in addition to writing your piece, Usury Country in Harper's, you've written a book, The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America. And I'd like you to talk about how this, how these payday loans fit in with the bigger story, especially a story we did last week with Reverend Jesse Jackson, and that is the story of student loans.
Yeah, in The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America, I look again at this rising economic inequality in the United States, this growing gap between rich and poor. The trap focuses on a different group of people. If payday loans are for the lower middle class or working poor, we might say, the trap is about college-educated professionals. But it argues that this increasing gap between rich and poor poses problems for this group as well, which, of course, compared to the lower middle class, is of course, relatively well off. And the choice it imposes on the upper middle class is not whether or not to take out a payday loan, but whether or not to sell out, whether or not to do a job that will pay them a lot of money, but in which they don't believe, and which will both sort of hurt the country in that they're not doing something more service-oriented, but also make them feel like they've sold out. So student loans are a big part of the trap. As we've shifted towards a privatized system of higher education, relying more and more on debt and more specifically on bank-issued private debt, the debt loads of students who attend both public and private colleges, and particularly professional schools and graduate schools. And the University of California at Berkeley, which is ostensibly a public school, charges $25,000 tuition for its law school. So even students from public schools are emerging with large debt loads. It ends up dictating career choice to a very disturbing extent. I think it's one of the things that drives a lot of the troubling trends in our society politically, including the revolving door in Washington, where people who had, say, worked in a congressman's office on issues they believed in turn around and triple, quintuple their salary by going to K Street and lobbying.
Now, perhaps with the economy and even these blue chip law firms laying off so many of their associates, maybe there will be a trend in the other direction, or at least volunteering at public service law firms and law groups like Legal Services and Legal Aid.
Well, yes, Amy, we can certainly hope that as these jobs dry up, people will do other things. But I think we need to take a more systematic view of the problem. I mean, just by having these jobs dry up, people with large debt loads are just going to default on their student debt. I think we really need to rethink how we fund higher education in this country. Again, going to the Center for Responsive Lending platform for a 36% interest rate cap. Again, I think that would be great, and we should. Senator Durbin has a bill along these lines that Thomas Gagin, who wrote the companion piece in the April issue of Harper's, mentioned earlier this week on this program, passed that bill. But what my article tries to do is create a larger context and show why people end up going into the payday lender. Things like health care reform, where if someone's child gets sick, it doesn't put them into the red. Something like increased better public transportation, especially in Southern California. If your car breaks down and you're working poor, you go to the payday lender. You know the public transit is often inadequate to get you to work for a week until you get your car fixed. So we really need to take a much broader look at what kind of country we want to be if we want to address these problems.
Daniel Brook, I want to thank you for being with us. He has written in his article, Usury Country, Welcome to the Birthplace of Payday Lending, in the latest issue of Harper's Magazine. His book is called The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat and Winner Take All America. And we also want to thank Gina Green for being with us, from California, spokesperson for the Center for Responsible Lending. New report out today on payday loans, and we'll link to it at democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, President Obama is expected to unveil a revised Afghanistan strategy Friday that will focus on expanding and improving the Afghan National Police Force. The Afghan police have been the target of recent attacks, and insurgents killed 9 police officers and injured 6 in the southern and central parts of the country Thursday. Richard Holbrook, the special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, told a security conference in Brussels last Saturday that the president's new plan would address the widespread perception that the police are, quote, the weak link in the security chain. President Obama's revised Afghanistan policy is also expected to send more troops to counter the Taliban's expanding influence in the southern part of the country, which the New York Times reports is made possible by direct support for the Taliban by operatives in Pakistan's military intelligence agency. Investigative journalist and Corp Watch managing editor Pratap Chatterjee traveled recently to Afghanistan and asked a number of Afghans what they would like to see from the new American president. Here is a short report.
One of the top priorities for President Barack Obama is how to tackle the growing power of the Taliban and the deteriorating security situation in Afghanistan. Corp Watch and KPFA met with a number of Afghans, from students to parliamentarians, to ask them what they think the new president should do. Sitting in his darkened flat during a power cut, Mir Ahmed Joindar, a member of the Afghan parliament, made several recommendations for the new president.
First of all, this should build Afghan army. For Afghan army, to have an Afghan strong army to be able to defend the country. Second was, this should not blunt attacks by B-52 or Chinook or pilotless planes. This should have Afghan guides. This should have a coordination with the Afghan army for any military operation they are doing. Thirdly, this should change their policy on the economic development of Afghanistan he should focus. The people should understand. They should, people should. It should be tangible for the people to have the change in their lives for Afghanistan.
The Obama administration plan to increase troop levels in Afghanistan is destined for failure, says Tariq Osman, a former Taliban official who now works for the Asia Foundation.
Afghan will never accept the military presence of any country, even if that's Saudi Arabia, if that's US. And based on that reason, increasing troops will not give them anything rather than more problems and more challenges. I think if he take action on this, this will be another mistake by US.
Some parliamentarians are even calling for negotiations with the Taliban, like Faisal Azeki, a Northern Alliance member of the Afghan parliament.
A proverb in Persian which says, it means that when it is still possible to untie a knot by your fingers, do not do it by your teeth. So this means that whenever it's possible to solve a problem through negotiating, you don't have to fight.
Students at the American University in Kabul say that they hope that the new administration will fulfill Obama's campaign slogan of change by making a clean break with all the Bush administration's policies.
As Mr. Obama says, the change we need. And he's right, we need it in Afghanistan also.
Students agreed that joining this recommendation to train the local military should be top priority. Abdul Hakim Maraban, a business student at the American University in Kabul.
I would request Obama to change the strategy their strategy that they are employing in Afghanistan, and they should send the troops that they could train the Afghan military, not the foreign military, because we are happy for they can do capacity building for them. In many places, the foreign troops go, hit the Taliban, and then go back. The foreign military cannot control that place because there are very few. They just go for the missions. And so there is no one to control that place then.
Shakila, a student from the Wardak province at the American University in Kabul, said that she liked Obama's campaign promise to increase non-military aid for basic needs like education.
I like Obama's idea about the non-military assistance to Afghanistan. I think we need to focus on the educational system.
This plea for non-military aid for Afghans was echoed by ordinary citizens such as this barber in Kabul's Shahr-e-Now district.
The next president of the United States, Barack Obama, he's the one, right? I think he should provide more aid to Afghanistan, more assistance to Afghanistan. He should not forget Afghanistan. He shouldn't just say things now that he's the president of the United States and leave the job incomplete in Afghanistan.
Obama has asked for $75 billion for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq in his 2009 budget. Whether any of this money will trickle down to ordinary citizens in the remote rural provinces of Afghanistan who still lack basic services like water and electricity remains to be seen. For CorpWatch and KPFA, I'm Pratap Chatterjee with Ronald Nobu Sakamoto in Kabul.
Pratap Chatterjee is also the author of the new book, Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. In a recent article for CorpWatch, Chatterjee analyzes President Obama's new strategy for Afghanistan and asks who will win the contracts to train the Afghan police and soldiers. Well, Pratap Chatterjee joins us now here in our Firehouse studio to answer that question and more. Welcome, Pratap. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Juan.
That analysis of what President Obama is about to unveil?
Well, this strategy is supposed to be released tomorrow, Friday, or early next week before he heads to Brussels for the NATO summit. And in that, he's expected to say that they're going to ramp up the number of soldiers and police to 400,000, doubling that. And one of their problems, there have been GAO reports for the last 5 years, and each year they come up with the same answer, that the police and the army are ineffective. In fact, there was a 2008 report that said after spending $10 billion, 0% of Afghan police were actually capable. About 3% were able to do maneuvers with the U.S. So they've actually launched a new strategy called Focused District Development, which involves DynCorp, which is this company from Virginia, taking the police out of their districts for 8 weeks training. The entire district trains with DynCorp, and then they get reinserted. And now, supposedly, the success rate has risen from 0% to 3% to 19%. So they have asked, the Pentagon has asked, to ramp up this civilian police training strategy and introduce a lot more, you know, civilian trainers throughout Afghanistan. The trouble with that is they haven't even been able to get the number of police trainers they need in the first place. And the kind of police trainers they're hiring, a lot of them are people, you know, they're people with beat cop experience, you know, from Kansas or Washington. And a lot of the DynCorp police trainers I've met in places like Iraq, not in Afghanistan, say that they're overwhelmed. They're not really prepared to train people to fight a civil war.
And Pratap, on this particular trip, what parts of the country were you able to visit? And also, what was your sense in terms of the general population, how it's viewing this extended and continued U.S. and foreign occupation?
Well, I went to Bamiyan in central Afghanistan, where the Buddhas were blown up. And I went to Mazar-e-Sharif in the north, and I was actually revisiting this. I'd been there 7 years before, right after the fall of the Taliban. And, of course, I went to Kabul. And my sense was that people, as in the previous video, people are very interested in seeing local security being, you know, bolstered. They would like to see much more power in the hands of local people. Because as the students were saying, when the Americans come in and they start bombing people and then they leave, you know, the mess is left for the Afghans to clean up. So people, a lot of people actually would like to see a foreign presence. They would like to see a multilateral presence, but they would like to see it support the local capacity. And that's what they feel like doesn't exist. And the trouble with Americans coming in and having their own strategy is and bombing people in Pakistan on the border is that, in fact, it defeats sometimes, you know, what might happen locally.
Prathap, I wanted to go with you to Bamiyan here, this piece that you have done in central Afghanistan, once home to the iconic Buddhist statues, to look at how life has changed for the people of the region since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. Prathap files this report.
Afghanistan is world famous for the giant statues of the Buddha that were carved into hillsides behind me centuries ago. In 2001, the Taliban blew these statues up. Since they were ousted 7 years ago, UNESCO has poured millions of dollars into preserving the architectural heritage of this area. Yet the surrounding community lacks electricity, potable water, and has just one proper hospital. CorpWatch and KPFA traveled by land on the Parwan Road to the remote interior Bamiyan province to investigate what had happened to the ethnic Hazara refugee community. We found that after hundreds of Hazara villages in the surrounding communities were killed by the Taliban in the late 1990s and buried in mass graves, thousands fled to other parts of the country and even as far away as Iran to avoid persecution. Today, many have returned, but as Shawa Ali, a peasant who had hidden in Ghazni, explains, they still live a very hard life in villages like Samara because of the lack of any reconstruction projects to provide them with basic services like clean water and electricity.
As you can see with my hands, these hands are completely hardened and chapped, different than yours. When the Taliban invaded Bamiyan, my son and I fled during the night to Ghazni. The Taliban destroyed our house and everything we owned. My son and I labored hard, pulling big carts full of timber and heavy loads until we could earn enough money to return back to Bamiyan and work the land growing wheat. I'm injured from years of heavy manual labor, but I still have to work hard, otherwise we would starve. But we still don't own the land. It's still owned by somebody else.
In Dragon Valley, in another part of Bamiyan, many Hazara who had fled to Iran have returned to live a hand-to-mouth existence. Khadija and Najiba, two women from Kowloon, explained that the government has not helped them.
We were happy in Iran. It was good. The weather was warm. We had a good life there. But it was still someone else's country. When the government told us we had to go back home, we wanted to return to start a new life. But they haven't helped us at all. They told us they were going to give us wood, supplies, and doors, but they've given us nothing. No help whatsoever.
The government hasn't done anything for us. They just say they will. They just came by once, gave us some water, some clothes, but that's it. They haven't done anything for us.
While the women cook and men look for manual labor on construction sites, even children have to work weaving carpets for their families to survive.
Abdul Karim, the father of these two children, explains that he returns from the town empty-handed most of the time.
We have nothing. No work, no electricity, no help from the government or NGOs. I'm not happy with my life here. As you have seen, everything was destroyed. Right now, our situation is so terrible, so of course I have no hope for the future.
We return from Bamiyan to Kabul to ask Mir Ahmed Joinder, a member of the Afghan parliament, why there was no electricity or potable water in Bamiyan.
As luck would have it, Joinder faced the same dilemma the day we visited him at his home, where we interviewed him by the light of a kerosene lamp.
You see, we are in the city of Kabul. As a member of the parliament of Afghanistan, I'm sitting in front of you, but I do not have electricity in my house. What do you think of the rural areas? What the poor areas of the Kabul city in other parts of the country?
This is despite billions spent in development aid in Afghanistan by the United Nations and international development agencies. We asked the Deputy Minister for Electricity and Water, Wali Sharuzai, why there was such little progress.
Most people call Afghanistan a post-conflict nation, post-conflict, just like other countries that have had conflicts. My terminology is a little bit different. I call it post-devastation. I would bring advisors and sit down and write these projects for the donors to understand what is the need. Like a patient speaking of the problems that the patient has, where it's hurting and when it started and how bad the pain is and this and that. Fortunately, this patient in here, Afghanistan, could not speak, what are my problems? And you have to find out what is the problem and then, of course, bring the prior diagnosis and problem medication.
Yet the deputy minister's words ran counter to what we had heard from Dr. Ghulam Mohammed Nadir, the chief medical officer of Bamiyan's only hospital, who told us that he could change the basic sanitation in local villages, dramatically reducing health problems and saving lives with just one $10 million demonstration grant.
If we received that kind of funding that you mentioned, we could spend it on creating a healthy public water supply. I believe having clean water is the most essential aspect to human health and to prevent diseases. At the very least, we need to educate the people about how important it is to have proper sanitation, clean water supply, and how they can protect themselves from waterborne diseases.
We later discovered that $10 million was a huge sum of money in Bamiyan. The sum total in aid spent in the province over the first 3 years by the U.S. Agency for International Development after the defeat of the Taliban. The money spent in the entire province of Bamiyan is less than 1% of the $1 billion allocated to Afghanistan over the same time period. Most of the money went to places like Kandahar, where the Taliban is very active, or to Helmand to combat the opium drug lords. But because Bamiyan has neither opium nor Taliban, it has been ignored by the U.S. government. The only hope for Bamiyan is a handful of wealthy tourists who journey here to see the site of the exploded Buddhas. For CorpWatch and KPFA, I'm Protheb Chatterjee with Ronald Nobu Sakamoto in Afghanistan.
This is Democracy Now!, and we'll be back with Protheb Chatterjee. We'll also be joined by Gareth Porter to talk about both Afghanistan and Iraq in a minute. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest here in studio in New York is Prothap Chatterjee, the award-winning investigative journalist and managing editor of Corp Watch, author of, well, his latest book is Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. Juan?
Well, Prothap, one of the things as President Obama looks to ramp up the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, there's still a lot of misconception in terms of the nature of the resistance there. I guess most Americans see it as a unified resistance. Your sense from your travels there about the nature of the groupings of the various guerrilla organizations that are fighting the U.S.?
Well, it's very fractured. There are a lot of different groups. And one of the best examples is actually a journalist by the name of Nir Rosen, who embedded with the Taliban and traveled to visit them, but on his way there got kidnapped by a different group of the Taliban. And they actually had to get, you know, requests from different groups to get him released. And this has happened to a number of people, is there are fiefdoms in each of the different areas, whether you go to Wardak province or Logar province or, you know, down to coast, you're going to find different people who control different sections. And sometimes they talk to each other and sometimes they don't. Now, they are unified in their hatred of the U.S. troops, but that doesn't necessarily mean they actually agree with each other. And so it can be very problematic dealing with them, even, you know, as journalists trying to, you know, I haven't embedded there, but I know other people who have.
Tell us who Bruce Rydell is.
Bruce Rydell is the man who's in charge of Obama's Afghanistan and Pakistan strategy. He's drawing up the new strategy that will be unveiled tomorrow or Monday when Obama heads to Brussels. He's actually a 29-year veteran of the CIA. He was at Langley mostly as an analyst, and he came into this world as an analyst, rather not into this world, but
he
started his career when Sadat was assassinated, and he was asked to investigate the jihadis. And so he looked into Zawahiri and people like this. And this is going back a couple of decades. And he has continued to follow that. He is now actually at the Brookings Institution, and he's on loan to the National Security Council, where his job is coming up with this new strategy. Now, he is somebody who really believes in a unified Taliban and al-Qaeda and believes you need to be able to target them. So this policy of, you know, drone attacks and all this stuff are the kinds of things that he is very interested in. His policy will be unveiled. You know, it's partly, you know, the Richard Holbrooke just came back, Mike Mullen, all these other people are feeding into the strategy that they will unveil. But it's been leaking all over the place. I mean, we've been reading, you know, parts of it, you know, in The Guardian and the New York Times and places like that.
Well, we'd like to bring into this conversation the other major conflict in that part of the world, the war in Iraq. Nearly 4 weeks ago, President Obama declared that U.S. combat operations would end in Iraq by August of 2010.
As a candidate for president, I made clear my support for a timeline of 16 months to carry out this drawdown, while pledging to consult closely with our military commanders upon taking office to ensure that we preserve the gains we've made and to protect our troops. These consultations are now complete, and I've chosen a timeline that will remove our combat brigades over the next 18 months. So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
Under President Obama's plan, all combat troops will be pulled from Iraq, but a transition force of up to 50,000 will remain after August of 2010. Despite the president's pledge, new evidence has emerged that the U.S. plans to keep combat brigades in Iraq, but they will operate under a different name.
Investigative reporter Gareth Porter of Interpress Service has revealed some of the brigade combat teams currently in Iraq will stay beyond August 2010 and will be renamed so-called Advisory and Assistance Brigades. Gareth Porter joins us with Prothap Chatterjee here in New York. His latest article is called Despite Obama's Vow, Combat Brigades Will Stay in Iraq. So, Gareth Porter, how do you know this and what exactly is the plan, as you understand it?
Well, the evidence of this plan to continue to keep combat brigades in Iraq past the August 31st deadline is very clear from looking into the military planning that has been done with regard to the brigade combat teams. The basic combat organization of the U.S. Army in Iraq for the past 6 years So I basically began to talk to some of the people who've been close to the military planning, specifically in the U.S. Army, over the past few months. And there's no secret about this, in fact. What's happening is that the basic combat organization in Iraq, the Brigade Combat Team, is going to be slightly revamped by adding a few dozen, perhaps more than that, officers who will be doing the advising and assistance directly with the Iraqi military and police, perhaps some other institutions as well, it's not clear. But they will be added on top of the existing Brigade Combat Team, rather than having any fundamental change in the structure of those organizations in Iraq. So what we have is the same combat potential, same combat organization, which will remain on the ground in Iraq. Now, there will be some drawdown. There's no doubt about that. But the promise that President Obama made on February 27th that all combat brigades would be withdrawn from Iraq, that simply is not true. It's not going to happen.
In other words, we're not dealing with a situation that most people associate with non-combat troops, like engineers or construction units that are involved in some kind of infrastructure work. These are actually combat units just renamed.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's not even that there's going to be military advisors who will be out in the field, you know, with the Iraqi units, which I think everyone understood would be the case when they decided to call these now. They're renaming the brigade combat teams the advisory and assistance brigades. So, I mean, that's the it's the sleight of hand administratively that is being used now to cover the fact that essentially nothing has changed except the addition of, as I say, a few, a relative handful of advisors who will be added to the structures that already exist. But it's not just people out in the field advising. It's going to be the same infantry units, the same infantry companies that exist today in Iraq will still be there when the United States is supposedly bringing its combat troops or its combat brigades home.
Gareth Porter, I wanted to play for you a comment from Defense Secretary Robert Gates. On March 1st, he appeared on Meet the Press and was asked about the 50,000 troops President Obama plans to keep in Iraq after August 2010.
They do have a very different mission, but their mission will be principally a training, assistance, advisory role. There will be a limited counterterrorism operations aspect to it, and we will still have some soldiers embedded with Iraqi units as part of the training effort. But it's a very different kind of arrangement, and our soldiers will be consolidated into a limited number of bases in order to provide protection for themselves and for civilians who are out working in the Iraqi neighborhoods and countryside as well. They will be called advisory and assistance brigades. They won't be called combat brigades.
Gareth Porter.
Well, of course, this was a very broad hint about what was to come. That is to say, he was essentially broadcasting indirectly, without saying so explicitly, that the plan was to rename the Brigade Combat Team's Advisory and Assistance Brigades, a term that does not have combat in it, in order to suggest that there's been a fundamental change in the structure of the units that are being deployed in Iraq. And of course, it's the quite the opposite, in fact. So the real question here is why the corporate news media did not pick up on this obvious hint and begin to look into this question and report what the real plan was for relabeling these units as non-combat units, which are in fact going to be continue to be combat units. In fact, what is really interesting here is that last December, as I point out in my article, the New York Times published an article which reported on planning that was being done in the Pentagon to relabel the existing units, combat units in Iraq, as non-combat units. And this was going to be, as the Times reported, a way in which the military could appeal to Obama to carry out his campaign promise, but still continue to keep combat brigades in Iraq. So this is exactly what has happened. But what's interesting is that there's been absolutely no reporting until my story published yesterday on the fact that this prediction by the New York Times back in December has now been realized.
Pratap Chatterjee, I'd like to ask you also about the issue of military contractors in Iraq, and obviously they're also in Afghanistan in extensive in numbers. And you were saying in the break you were seeing comparisons with some of the same problems in the United States occupations in both countries.
Well, in addition to the troops that Gareth mentioned, there are civilian police trainers and there are civilian army military trainers who accompany, you know, Afghan units in Afghanistan and Iraqi units in Iraq, and they do training on the ground. And so they are looking, in fact, the CEO of DynCorp in his last investor call about a month ago said, we're looking forward to actually a lot more work in Afghanistan based on what's happening. This is in February of 2009. So the contractors are expecting a boom because they expect, you know, to augment the military training teams. They do this. There's, as I mentioned, the focused district development training scheme in Iraq, in Afghanistan. It's actually sometimes very hard to keep these training schemes separated, because when you look at them, it's the same trainers, it's the same companies. And in fact, interestingly enough, when you look at the GAO reports, the Department of Defense Inspector General reports, the same problems. Whether you look, you know, at Fallujah or Najaf and the training problems that they had back in 2003, or the problems they're having today in Khost and Patka in Afghanistan, the same problems keep recurring. I keep thinking I'm reading a report about Iraq from 2003, and I suddenly realize I'm reading a GAO report from 2008.
Now, this issue of continued policy from Iraq, which President Obama condemned, I mean, he was opposed to the war in Iraq, to Afghanistan. Gareth Porter, I wanted to ask you about this. I was on a flight from Grand Rapids this past weekend, and I sat next to a military consultant, been in the military for a long time, then aerospace industry, now a consultant. And he said, yes, this is great for the military contractors, the war. But he said, as an American, he is baffled by President Obama pushing this surge and expanded war in Afghanistan. He said he is shocked by it, as many in the military are. And I wanted to ask you, Gareth, about, well, Lieutenant General Eikenberry, who has been nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He is the former top U.S. commander in Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007, now would be the main diplomatic representative for the United States.
Yes, this is a part of a trend, not simply to have high-ranking military officers play some of the key policy roles and even diplomatic roles in the Obama administration. Of course, there's James Jones as the National Security Advisor, as well as the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair. But in the case of Eikenberry as the new ambassador in Afghanistan, this is disturbing for more than one reason. He is both a very enthusiastic supporter of the idea that that this should be a NATO affair in Afghanistan, that this should be a NATO war. And one of those who has been pushing the idea that unless NATO can show success in Afghanistan, then it's going to be in serious trouble as an institution. So there's a question of whether some of these people are pushing the war, in part at least, because of their affinity to NATO.
Gareth Porter and Pratap Chatterjee, I want to thank you very much both for being with us. That does it for our broadcast. We begin our Standing Up to the Madness tour. We'll be in Seattle and Olympia, Washington on Sunday, Washington, D.C. on Monday. I'm Amy Goodman, Luan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.